So thank you all for coming tonight. A few hours ago, I was talking to my son, who lives in West Palm Beach, who was on his way to a Super Bowl party. And we talked, so I realized we'd have some competition tonight, but I'm glad that some came. I just want to say a few words. Some of you know that we just finished a retreat up in Tampa, 4-day retreat. Which several members from Naples, Fort Myers, Marco area came. And it dealt with what in Buddhist terminology, Sanskrit, dealt with vipassana, which is often translated as the higher way of seeing. And it's a certain body of practices and teachings within the Buddhist meditative tradition. And just kind of, since some of you, or many of you, or some of you are new to kind of the larger Buddhist path, the resting ground, or the foundation, for living we could say a good life, an altruistic life, a transformative life, a deeply meaningful life, is at the foundation level to, we could say, get our act together in terms of the way we conduct our life. That traditionally encompasses things like morality, which means sort of we're aware of what type of actions that we do with our body, that we do with our words, and most importantly, or as importantly, that originally come first with our mind, that actions of body, speech, and mind have the capacity of creating goodness, clarity, understanding, compassion, confidence, etc. Or else the actions of our body, speech, and mind have the capacity to do harm to ourselves, to others, to create suffering, pain, misunderstanding, conflict, et cetera, et cetera. So if there's not a toning down, a quieting, and a sort of a transformation at that level, that very human level, which really has a lot to do with how we relate to the world, to other people, to our environment, to our world, etc., we will always have an unsettled mind, which even if we are making attempts at the meditative level or the insight level, can always be undermined, sabotaged, or just made much more difficult, because we're always dealing with the results of our activities, of our actions, on the level of relationship. When I say relationship, I mean a really even relationship to our own body, how we treat our body, what we put into our body, what we put in to our body minds, as well as, again, in how we relate to each other. So basically, we want to stop doing harm, and we want to start doing good, to have goodness be the result of our actions of body, speech, and mind, rather than a continuation of a perpetuation of conflict, of misunderstanding, suffering. That capacity to create harmony, right, to get the drama out of life, and to end the continued creation, you know, in Buddhism there's that word karma, the law of cause and effect, which means we need to, no matter what the effects of our past actions that we're still kind of receiving the results from in the present and may in the future, in the present, we have the capacity of being impeccable to the best degree of that we can in our actions right now. You know, we can make the commitment to really stop doing harm to others, and to really do our best to live a more altruistic life. Again, that will have a lot to do with our mind state and the state of our body and the state of our relationships and interrelationships. So with right action of body, speech, and mind, etc., somewhat fortified by our capacity to be very attentive, then our attempts at, I could say, training or retraining the mind. I hesitate to say retraining in some aspect. For many of us, even the concept of that we have the capacity of training our mind to kind of be the way we'd like it to be is a foreign concept. So training the mind, and also in a sense of retraining the mind. And one of the basics of the retraining the mind in the aspect of Buddhist meditative life is mindfulness. Right? That capacity to have the mind present to unfolding in the moment reality. Actually, it is a type of awareness at its very basic. We could say that, you know, all our fellow mammals, our fellow animals, that's the time they're living in, right? They live in the present, right? They're not lost in the past, they're not ruminating in the past, they're not looking, they're not thinking about the way things could have been, should have been, ought to have been, they're not ruminating on their past mistakes, right? They're present. Whatever the presence is for birds and squirrels and grizzly bears and fish and, you know, whatever that present is, it is something just like this moment. And at the same time, they are not out there in the future worrying, concerned, fantasizing, etc., nor are they obsessively conceptualizing and labeling all their present experience. It is a very capacity to be fairly open and naked. Naked in the sense that one doesn't need to label everything, to have a thought about everything, to put a spin on every little experience, every person we run encounter, right? We're able to be just mindful. Right? To eat, to drink, to look, to love, to relate, you know, without the fog of conceptualization and projection, right? Capacity to live in the present moment. This is a kind of a very powerful basis for just living our ordinary life. And we know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you talked about mindfulness in the mental health world, and they looked at you like you were nuts. But now mindfulness is something that is almost mainstream, right? And is being researched and And now the therapeutic value of mindfulness and the treatment of this and the treatment of that, of stress disorders, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, I mean, this is all being known. Right? There's a tremendous therapeutic capacity that comes from a mind that is not lost in projections and conceptualization and rumination. Plus, there's a great freedom in one's capacity to be alive, fully present in the here and now. So that's kind of the foundation that we previously talked about in terms of the actions of our body, speech, and mind. Now we add mindfulness. The life is greatly enriched by that capacity. And then, kind of moving up the ladder, we could say, then, and again, for many people, the areas of practice that we already talk about are enough, right? You know, I think most people, in terms of involvement in religion, sort of it is mostly in terms of actual practice, other than faith, is kind of moral activity, right? Do unto others as you would have others do unto you, kindness, etc. Mindfulness, which is more of a mind culture, cultivation, is something more unique to the meditative traditions. But oftentimes, you know, there is a revelation, the more we kind of clean up our act, that the real seat of our unhappiness, our suffering, our alienation, our sense of disconnection, etc., has less to do with others and more to do with myself. And so that capacity to more deeply explore one's own experience, one's own reality, usually involves, in addition to mindfulness, the ability to concentrate. Okay? Mindfulness takes us in the present moment. Concentration allows us to rest the mind on something with some sort of intensity and some sort of capacity to stably place it somewhere. Right? The way I kind of often use the example is, you know, if it's dark room, it's good to have a flashlight. But if it's always like this, or if we're always flickering on and off, it's hard to really do any kind of serious exploration. Right? I mean, one needs a steady beam of light, and one needs the capacity to hold it steady. Right? So one can really see what's there. And mindfulness and concentration are like that. Right? Again, you know, we don't have to be perfect hermits and yogis and meditators, but there seems to be some capacity of calming and clearing and focusing the mind. All that becomes the foundation of this next level, of which our last four-day retreat in Tampa was focused on. And for those of you who either are members or get our emails, you know we're about to embark on a four-month intensive period of practice. We have about 50 members involved, continuing the exploration of these teachings and practices of insight. And this is where we begin to look at, you know, who and what we are, right? What is this mind? And again, not in some sort of intellectual conceptualization, because most of us would agree, or most people say, you know, I would say, you know, people say, who are you? I'm Fred. And you would say, well, you know, what is Fred? And most people would say, well, my body and my mind, right? So when in the practice of Vipassana or insight, we actually look into what that really means as an experience. And we look at it in very clear ways. To see what is the nature of this mind. Is it permanent or impermanent? Is it the source of happiness or suffering? Is it really a thing, an entity, or is it not? What is the self? What is the ego? Does it really exist? If it does exist, how does it exist? Right? What is a thought? Where do they come from? Where do they go? Questions like that. What is an emotion? What is a feeling? What is a memory? I mean, many of us can discourse on these things, can conceptualize and philosophize. But now we're actually talking about what it really is, right? So somebody says, what is a watch? If a watch exists in reality, I can go what? I can at least show you something that has the word watch, you know, that we refer to as a watch. And we can, it can be seen. It can be analyzed. It can be known in a certain way. In the same way, we need to look at things that are even more central, such as mind. What is my mind? Right? What is a thought? Especially since most people are ruled by their thoughts. We need to ask a question at some point. What is a thought? How real are they? How big are they? How permanent are they? How true are they? Right? Same thing with emotions. Again, because one can't help but notice that that is the main way that people kind of run their lives. So in the practice of Vipassana, of insight, we turn that light of mindfulness and concentration on directly our own experience. And actually, in this case, we are following simply the example of the founder of Buddhism, the Buddha, Shakyamuni. And that's what he did. Right? All his understandings, all his insights only came from his own capacity to look deeply into his own mind and experience. Right? He didn't read about it. He didn't come to his insight through discussing it with other philosophically bent teachers and practitioners of the day, even though there was a lot of that going on, and I'm sure he participated at some level in that. But eventually he had to know himself. He had to have direct experience. So that's simply, in 15 minutes, is a kind of, just wanted to give you a sense of what this path is about. And maybe next week, I don't know what you have planned, maybe there could be some time for various people who went to the retreat last week to share their actual experiences of practice. Possible. Good. And I know there are people who went who've been to many retreats, and there are some people who went first time, so it could be an interesting sharing of experience. So before I jump into our formal teachings for tonight, does anybody have any questions that they bring, either what I just talked about or in terms of the practices we did here tonight, or just your own practice in terms of how you bring the teachings and practice in your daily life? Does anybody have any questions or concerns? And don't be shy. Yes.
I was wondering if you can comment upon, in the comparative sense, the experience of psychodynamic psychotherapy, which also focuses on insight and the mobilization of individuals to change perception, attitudes, feelings, and action, and the Buddhist function and process of mindfulness, which is so eloquently and clearly delineated, are they in some sense complementary, or does one go in another direction? How would you weigh these two in a comparative sense?
Okay, good question. I won't go too deep into this because, you know, many people have. And Sheldon knows my background professionally was as a therapist, you know, health and psychology and all that. I see, again, I would say both deal with suffering, right? I mean, obviously people don't enter the mental health world, psychiatry, psychology, psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, because of their happiness, right? I mean, people enter that world because at some level or another there is suffering. Personal suffering, interpersonal suffering. And in that sense, this is what the Buddha, I mean, we know that the Buddha, is some of the basis of his teaching is the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering. Again, differences, but again, I think they're looking at the same thing. And again, obviously, good psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, psychiatry, whatever, has to do with some level of remediation of the suffering of the person involved in the process. And obviously, that the Buddha said very clearly, I only teach the cessation of suffering. Okay, so in that sense, I think we're looking at the same thing. Both, you know, ancient meditators and practitioners of Dharma and other ancient paths of meditations and mind and, you know, the modern, you know, 100-year-old, more or less, you know, world of psychology and Western psychotherapy. So looking at the same animal. I mean, I think, without going too deep into it, I mean, I think there's one very obvious distinction. Western psychology bases it all around ego and self. And how to remediate the suffering of that ego through various kinds of insights, understandings, healings, etc. So basically, it is a more coherent, more integrated, better functioning ego self. Right? But let's not go beyond that or look beyond that or deeper than that. It never questions the very instrument itself of what is a self or what is an ego. Is it real? Is it self-existent? You know, it looks at thoughts. I mean, I was a cognitive therapist. It looks at behavior, but it never asks what is a thought or never asks the client, patient, to really look intrinsically at the nature of thought. Right? It looks at negative thoughts, positive thoughts, what thoughts create. So, in terms of the insight that I'm talking about, it really isn't, it's talking about the insight into the basic structure of experience. And here we're talking about self and other. Is there really a self and other? Or is that just a mental construct? Right? And it looks at, again, not just a better functioning, better coping, therefore happier, more integrated self, but a really, in Buddhism, and this goes back to the Buddha said, you know, the essential suffering of a human being is because they perceive themselves or misperceive themselves as a separate self. So in that place, I think there's a departure. But if you're asking me, are they antagonistic? I don't see so. I really think there's certainly, if we want to kind of had a model, it's really just a deepening model or a deeper looking model, and they certainly work together. Because in a certain way, Western psychology in the last 100 years has developed, lots of good tools for helping people. Helping people who are in emotional suffering, interpersonal suffering, etc. But only to a certain extent. And as I say, Buddhism, I think, has done the same thing at that level, but also takes it to a much deeper level, a level that most people aren't that interested in going. Right? And I don't say that in any negative way. I mean, most human beings never really want to ask the deeper questions. You know, like, what's this whole thing about? Right? Well, most human beings will want to find out, how can I work this thing better that I'm a little happier and not so sad or depressed or anxious? You know, we are looking... In other words, how can I explain? It's sort of like... it's sort of like even in terms of social economics, some people are going always, how can I kind of, reform this a little bit, right, to make it better? But there are other people who kind of go, well, maybe we need to look at the whole way it's operating, you know. Maybe we got to get outside the box, right, and really see whether there's another whole way of going about. You know, such as Well, just such as right now with our environmental issues, right? Our global warming and our, you know, I mean, some people think, well, you know, we just got to tweak the system a little bit, right? And there's some people who say, no, the whole way we relate to our planet and energy and consume, you know, use, you know, needs to be looked deeply at. Anyhow. And so again, it's I mean, obviously, the Buddha was unique in his perspective that he took the deep look. And the interesting thing I think about him from a personal level is because some people say, well, does that mean I have to be profoundly suffering in my life to question deeply? And we know, at least from what the Buddha's story is that he was not in a state of personal suffering. Actually, he was at a stage of life when things were working for him. He was young, he was married, he had a good job, he had a nice house, you know what I mean? I mean, basically, from what we know, his life was at that stage was working for him. He had no oblique suffering or difficulty. But yet he was somebody, when he observed suffering around him, he was very moved by it, and he used that to go, you know, well, have I built my happiness, my well-being, you know, on a house of sand, we could say. You know, is it built on a foundation of sand? Because everything that's working for me now, I got a healthy body, I got, you know, I got stability in my life, things are working for me, people like me, people love me, I'm well known, you know, all that stuff. You know, I got pretty things. He realized if all that was taken away or seriously disturbed, right? Like what happened if I got sick and I wasn't feeling great anymore, right? What happened if this handsome body of mine began to age? Right? What happened if all my youthful energy began to dissipate? What happened if I began to lose the things, the people in my life that give me happiness, right? And so he was able to use this wonderful capacity we have for self-reflection and insight of our mind to go beyond his own personal experience and to look at the human experience, and that shook him up. So again, obviously, some of us come to the path or come to deep questioning by our own personal suffering, our own personal difficulties, our own personal losses, et cetera, which make us look more deeply into life. But some of us come to it also from, in addition, a philosophical event, you know, where we kind of look, more deeply into life itself, the life of others and others, and we can see what's going on. Nice music. Yes.
Concerning insight, what is meant by mind? Does it mean awareness or the content of mind or what?
Well, it has different meanings and they're different words. But in the word that I was using it, I was referring to that which most human beings refer to. So most people, when they refer to themselves, right? So your name is?
John.
And now if I said John, well, John is composed of what? I mean, that which is, John's a word. You'd say it refers to what? Okay, your body and your mind, right? For people, not everybody here knows what skandhas are, but you're basically your body and your mind, right? And so, in that which we call our mind, right?
Well, usually when people say mind, they mean the contents of the mind.
Okay, so let's say people say the contents of their mind, which would be what? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, right? Consciousness itself, we would say is the mind, right? Now, saying a word mind, and I don't want to go too much into this, but this is what we go on retreat and do intensives about. Usually when we say the word mind, we think of it as our body, as an entity, right? Such as my mind, or I have a mind, Or my mind is made up of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, consciousness, right? As if it's a thing, an entity. Right? Well, that, from the meditative point of view, is open to dispute. that if you begin to look deeply into your mind, right, that which from which thoughts, feelings, perceptions seem to be arising and passing, is there an entity, a thing called the mind? In the same way we talk about self, right? My mind, my body. As if there's a me, an I, a John, who has a body and a mind. Right? I mean, that's the way we talk, right? So when I say my body and mind, it presupposes that there's something called Fred that has a body and mind, right? I mean, I'm just speaking the way we ordinary human beings talk to each other, right? But in insight, we actually look into that to discover, is there really such a thing as myself? Right? Is there such a thing as a mind, right? My thoughts, my feelings, my past, my future, right? And again, you know, this is not just academic or philosophical, because the self, you know, at least with 2,500 years of Buddhist experience, the self is the key operating principle in terms of how most people live their lives, right? They live their lives from the point of view of self. They advance the self, right? They retreat the self, they defend the self, they project the self, their lives are focused on getting their needs, their self's needs met, right? I need this, I need that, I don't want this, I don't want that, I like this, I don't like that, right? So if you pay attention to yourself and others, you'll see that is the central operating principle of all my experience and the way I organize everything. Everything is filtering through this I. Okay? Well, at this level of practice, going back to the Buddha, is there an I? Because if there isn't, then we're certainly devoting a hell of a lot of energy in our life to upholding something, advancing, protecting, getting its needs met for something that may not be as significant as we might imagine it to be. Right? So this is big stuff. I mean, it's not just for those who are deeply minded. It really has to do fundamentally with, why do I suffer? It is hard to suffer without a self. Right? Because when we're depressed, it's often because the self feels like it's lost something. Right? Or when we worry, the self is worried about something unwanted that may happen to it at some imagined point in the future. So it is worth looking deeply into this I. But even before we look deeply into it, it's probably good just to notice how much of our experience is always organized around a self. In this case, it would be called Fred. But and again, you will find it is very hard to have an active emotional life, especially a life that has lots of anger and fear and resentment and hurt and sadness and fear and all that kind of stuff, but without having a very active self, that is very identified with that which is happening to it. When I was in retreat a week or so ago, I always have my watch with me, and I was talking to somebody in a private interview, and I said to them, if this watch was in a watch store, right, and if it fell to the ground, right, slipped off the counter, and somebody stepped on it and broke it, and if you were in the store and saw that happen, would you be upset? And the person said, of course, what? No. I mean, too bad it happened, but I wouldn't be upset. Okay, but let's say the same watch belonged to you. and it fell off, you know, you brought it in to be fixed, and it fell off the counter, and somebody stepped out and crushed it. How would you feel then? Oh, big time upset. Well, what's the difference? The same watch, having the same experience. What changed? My watch, right? When it's my watch, it's a big deal, right? When it's your watch, well, that's too bad. Well, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. Just that little bit of labeling creates an emotional drama. Right? And again, I mean, that goes on throughout the day. Right? Somebody says, God, Andy's just a terrible bell ringer. Oh, God, where did he learn? You know what I'm saying? And somebody, if somebody said that to me, I'd agree or disagree, but it wouldn't have any emotional content with me, right? But if somebody said to me, Fred, you are a terrible bell ringer. God, where did you, right? All of a sudden, it'd be what? Disappointment, hurt, anger, you know? Why? Because when it's all of a sudden about me, it has all this stuff around it, right? But the same thing could be happening to the person just, you know, a few feet away, and I'm fine with it. Same words, same, you know, capacity to evaluate the situation. Self is the key here. And so in this tradition, at this level, we want to look deeply into this self, matter of self. Again, because it is the very, when we talk about disconnection, when we talk about alienation, when we not feel like, when we feel lonely, when we feel not a part of, right? Try feeling lonely without a self. It's not easy. You know, next time you're feeling lonely, or next time you get a little free time, experiment with that. Right? Try to create loneliness without a self. Right? Try to feel like something's missing. Right? Without a self. Once you don't have a self, nothing's missing. Everything's fine, just the way it is. But who is that? What's that part of us? That voice of dissatisfaction. Anyhow, this is deep stuff. There's wonderful things in Dharma about the self. Thank you. I'm just going to, I'll just begin for a few minutes. It's one of these old Dharma poems, teaching poems. It's from I'm reading from a book called Mind at Ease, and it's just in the back in the appendix as one of these teaching poems called Precious Son, Padmakarpo. This is from the Tibetan tradition, Padmakarpo, I think that means white lotus. He was a great scholar, meditator, teacher in the 16th century. And this is a text called Precious Son. And it has different stanzas. I thought we could go through it, and there's different ones. So the first one is, this human body that you possess is not owned by you. It is borrowed, and you will not possess it for an indefinite period. While you have the opportunity to do something worthwhile, don't you think you should make good use of it? Please turn your mind within and reflect on it. So this is a good, this is his openers. Right? And again, a lot of these things we can read or listen to and go, oh yeah, I understand that, you know, it's not that hard to understand that. But we need to meditate deeply on this stuff so we get it in here. Right? It's not that hard for somewhat intelligent people to get it here. But it's only when you get it here that it becomes transformative. It makes us do something different with our life. So this human body you possess is not owned by you. Oh, Right? Owned by you means what? My body. Right? But no, it's just something that's come into my possession. Who gave it to me? My mother and my father, right? I didn't make it, did I? Anybody here make their own body? Anybody here pick their own body out? No. This body just came into being, right? And somebody named it. We didn't name it, right? So somebody gave us a body and gave us a name. It is borrowed, which means what? It is not going to be here forever. It's borrowed. That has implications, doesn't it? Impermanence of our body. We will not possess it forever. And even if we possess it for a good length of time, we have no idea the health status of it, right? We have no idea how long it'll be energetic. We have no idea what its condition will be, do we? So it is a gift to us. It is a wonderful vehicle for doing things. And he says, well, if you have this wonderful gift that has been given you, right, but you do not know, if you meditate on it, how long you will have it, right? Why don't you do something? You know, why don't you use it for good purposes? Make good use of it. So he says, again, turn your mind within and reflect on this. Because again, the reflection on impermanence, again, which is something I would imagine everybody here goes, yeah, I understand everything changes, nothing stays the same, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, 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 psychobabble, dharma babble. But there are implications if we get it. Right? We don't know how long we're going to be here. Right? And this body is a vehicle for awakening. This body mind's a vehicle for awakening. It's a vehicle for transformation. It's at least, at the very least, a vehicle for being doing some good in this world and helping human beings who are lost and suffering, many people, right? So why don't we make good use of it? Reflect on that it's a temporary possession. I don't know how long I'm going to have it. I act as if I'm going to have it forever, don't I? It's going to go on forever. That's one of our dreams. That's one of our delusions, isn't it? That this will go on forever. But if we look around at our own life, our own bodies, as well as the lives and bodies of our grandparents, our parents, all the generations, our peers, we'll see it's fabrication. People are, they're just leaving. They're exiting the stage all the time. And many of those who haven't exited, the state of their body is very different than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Right? And that's just a fact. So while we are still here and still have a body that is still somewhat usable, why don't we use it for good? Our own good, as well as the good of our fellow human beings. I'm going to do one more. Wholesome thoughts are only intermittent, like illuminations caused by lightning in the dark of a stormy night. On the rare occasions that you momentarily come to your senses, don't you think you should put some effort into doing something about it? Please turn your mind within and reflect on this. All right, so if first stanza dealt with the body. Now he's going, if you observe the content of your mind, right, you realize that on its own, really positive, wholesome thoughts are intermittent, which means they don't pop in too regularly, do they? Right? I mean, everybody here can take their own inventory of their mind to decide, you know, what the primary content of the mind is. But what he's suggesting, that wholesome thoughts, thoughts that are whole, that come from wholeness, right? That come from a sense of interconnection, right? When one comes from a sense of interconnection, loving kindness, compassion, helpfulness, altruism are all come more naturally. But for most of us, these kinds of thoughts are intermittent, random, and they're like illuminations caused by lightning in the dark of a stormy night, right? Which means what? When the lightning lights up the night, it is what? Short term. All of a sudden, the strike of lightning, all of a sudden we see. But then, 10 seconds later, it's gone. So it's saying, if in the course of your life, you have these moments of clarity, you have these moments of purpose, you have these moments when you go, oh, this is what feels right. This is the way to relate. This is the way to be. This is the way to this is what gives my life meaning or happiness. You know, we will all know those moments, right? When we know this is the right way. Say, you know, come to your senses. You know, or he says, in those moments we finally have come to our senses. But it's like it's like lightning in the dark. It's not going to last unless we what? Unless you put some effort into doing something about it. So he's saying, you know, the random lightning may light things up so we see, oh, look at all, there's a lot here. All of a sudden we see in the darkness. But again, when we know that, we no longer have to wait for lightning, right? We can create our own lights. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, if you have a backyard and you never have any lights in, it's always pitch black out there, and one day the lightning lights it up, you go, gee, this is pretty yard. You know, maybe I want to light it up myself. Right? So maybe I want to live a life of more intention. Right? More consciously live my life. Right? Moving in a direction that has meaning, purpose to me. And so, again, he's suggesting, I think, something we all know, that for many of us, early on, it's glimpses, it's intuitions, it's moments of clarity, right? It's feelings, but we never kind of reflect deeply enough on it that we really put it all together and make it into a new modus operandi for how we want to live our life, right? And if you combine that with the stanza before, which is what? You know, We're only here a short time. We don't know if we'll have the tools of this body mind with us for long. So you put these two together, you go, what? I need to stop just wasting time. Okay? I need to begin to live a life that's more consciously meaningful, more directive. Because if I just leave it to randomness, right? It's just intermittent. So, so that's, you know, we are used to reading fast, right? We turn pages, right? We read, and that's the way we read. And you know, many of us who've come up through the American educational system, we know cramming is very much part of the way we go about studying. Right? Let me just keep turning the pages, and as if turning the pages and making note, somehow, that's learning. But that's not really learning in what we need. Each of these like four lines are very meaningful. You know what I'm saying? I would hope that when you read this type of book, which are teachings that are meaning to wake us up, that you read like four lines and then really reflect, what does it mean? What is he saying? Make sure we get the meaning, the essence of what he's saying, and then most importantly go, and how does this relate to me and my life? Right? And so all of a sudden, you're not turning pages as quick as you used to, right? You may be reading a page a day, half a page a day, because you want to get the meaning, and you want to get the meaning for you. Right? It's only when you take it in as meaning and you take it in as application to yourself that you begin to think about implementation. How do I want to really bring this into my life? So it begins to work its magic. It'll never work its magic as long as it stays here. And it'll never work its magic as long as it stays in the page. There's no transformation in that. It's going to go from here to here to here to action. And then we've done justice to this teacher, because he's writing this why. He wants to help us. Right? He wants to help us. Right? He's giving us a teaching to help wake us up. And I'm sure he's a human being. He's sharing his experience. You can imagine that he's gone through this process of getting these truths. Right? And now he's trying to share them with us. So, please, when you read these kinds of texts, Buddhist texts, other types of spiritual, meditative, read them slowly and really reflect deeply on their meaning. And if you find them meaningful, then ask yourself, how do I want to take this into my life? So good. Thank you all for coming. 30. So we'll stop now.